The background to this talk is that the thing that grabbed me into Buddhism when I went to my first meditation classes with Sri Ratna was Sangharakshita's long historical view. And he talked about evolution and processes of history over long periods of time. And that really intrigued me because I was interested in evolution and that and long view of history. And so I wrote the book and I've been giving talks. And one of the themes that I've begun to explore is this interaction between evolution and Buddhism and economics. So this talk is actually about those three things, evolution, economics, and Buddhism. And the subtitle of it is Adam Smith, Charles Darwin, and the Buddha. And Adam Smith, if you don't know, I'll explain who he is. I assume that everybody knows who Charles Darwin and the Buddha is, but I'll explain who Adam Smith is. So I'm going to start going back to the time of the Buddha. And he lived between 500 and 400 BCE in northern India. And he lived during what the German philosopher Karl Jaspers called the Axial Age. Some of you will be familiar with this from Bhante's talks. So the Axial Age was that period, roughly between 800 and 200 BCE. And what Karl Jaspers says characterized that period was the emergence in different parts of the world of a new kind of spiritual and philosophical thinkers. So you had the Hebrew prophets in Palestine, you had Plato and the other Greek philosophers in Greece, you had Confucius in China, and the Buddha in India. And you may have heard of a woman called Karen Armstrong, who's one of the top specialists on comparative religion. She has written a book on the Axial Age, and she calls it the Great Transformation. And what she says is that when you look at all these spiritual and philosophical thinkers, including the Buddha, is that they all emphasize putting ethics at the center of the spiritual and philosophical life. They all talked about the importance of empathy and compassion, and they insisted that people must abandon their egotism and greed, their violence and unkindness. So this was what was in common across the great sages of the Axial Age. Now what's interesting is that the emergence of these new philosophical and spiritual philosophers and practitioners happened about the same time as there were quite significant changes in economic organisation. So at the core of the Axial Age came the first widespread use of coins, what we call money. That happened in the same period. The rise of the first significant trading markets between countries. And also what happened, critically, is that by the time of the Axial Age, in some parts of the world, the economies had developed enough so that there was an economic surplus. There was more than enough food being produced for the people alive in those particular societies. And what this meant was it was possible for some people to remove themselves from normal economic life and reflect and ponder on life's meaning. So in the Buddha's case, the developing economy of the Ganges Plains in northern India meant that he and many other ascetic and holy wanderers could leave home to pursue enlightenment, knowing that they could actually get their food each day given to them in the villages and the towns, that there was enough food for them to rely on being given their sustenance. So that was something significant was going on at that time, economically as well as spiritually. And then for 2,000 years from the time of the Buddha, in terms of economics, there was very little change around the world in the level of output or in the standard of living of people all around the globe. There were some small changes, but not much happened. And for much of that time, simply because they contain more people than other regions, India and China were the world's biggest economies. India and China were the world's biggest economies for most of that 2,000 years. And then what we observe is that sometime during the 16th, 17th and 18th centuries came a series of changes in conditions that led to the emergence of the economic system that we know as capitalism. Suddenly, things started to change, and change very rapidly. So after a long period of relative stability, or stasis, nothing changing, the world economy underwent a profound change with sudden, astonishing growth in output, astonishing growth in standards of living, better healthcare, better education, longer lives, and so on. No question about it, dramatic improvement in many aspects of life. But of course, accompanying this rapid growth, there came much disruption and suffering and resistance to that suffering and disruption. So it didn't happen in an easy way. And now, we seem to have reached, in many parts of the world, a kind of impasse, a blockage of increasing inequality, very high levels of unemployment, especially among young people, threats to the environment, and so on, terrible threats to the environment, linked to our economic system and our methods of production. And this is becoming more and more intensified over the last 30 to 40 years, linked to a particular form of capitalism that's often called neoliberal capitalism. A process that started with the election of Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom, the election of Ronald Reagan in the USA, the late 70s, early 80s. That marked quite a significant change. So a tremendous amount of evolution has happened in terms of our economic system over the last few hundred years, and still continues now with a certain degree of tension now. And I mentioned earlier that when Karen Armstrong wrote about the Axial Age, she called her book The Great Transformation. In my library at home, I have a second book, also called The Great Transformation. Very interesting, same title, written by a Hungarian economic historian called Karl Polanyi. And Polanyi is very little known these days, but for him, the Great Transformation was the emergence of capitalism and the sort of political ideology associated with capitalism. And what he says was significant about the emergence of capitalism and the emergence of the ideology associated with it is that for the first time, attempts were made to subordinate human society to the economic market. Previously, people thought about the economic market is there to serve society, and a shift took place, he argues, where human society was subordinated and is still subordinated to the economic market. So when you look at these two great transformations, what you find is two competing sets of values. With the Axial Age, you find the values of empathy and compassion. With the advent of capitalism and market liberalism, so-called, you find the values of self-interest and greed. So what we have playing out now, I believe, is the clash of these values. That's what's at stake. Which values does the world live by? And I want to explore the clash of these values by exploring the ideas of three particular people. The Buddha, Adam Smith, who you may not be familiar with, some of you. He was a Scottish moral philosopher who at the end of the 18th century published a book called The Wealth of Nations, an economics book, the first real substantial book on economics, which really explains what capitalism was becoming at that time. It's kind of seen as the Bible of economics by many modern economists. And the third person is Charles Darwin, whose book The Origin of Species on Evolution was published in 1859. And I'm going to start by looking at Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution. When people think of Darwin's theory of evolution, a phrase often comes into their mind, and that phrase is survival of the fittest. I hadn't realised this, but when I was researching the book The Buddha on Wall Street, I found out that for the first four editions of On the Origin of the Species, Darwin never used the term survival of the fittest. It was only in the fifth edition that he first used this phrase, survival of the fittest. Before that, he always talked about natural selection. And he borrowed this phrase, survival of the fittest, from a man called Herbert Spencer. And Herbert Spencer happened to be a very strong advocate of free markets and what's called laissez-faire capitalism, which is you let the capitalists rip and let them do what they want. You let the values of capitalism go without control and everything will be all right. So it was really unfortunate that that phrase, survival of the fittest, which was associated with Herbert Spencer and a particular view of capitalism and economics, was picked up by Darwin. So that economists began to use this phrase, survival of the fittest. And they reinterpreted what Darwin meant by fittest. They interpreted as the strongest, the most selfish, and the greediest. That's what the survival of the fittest meant to them. For Darwin, survival of the fittest simply meant that those best fitted or suited to their environment would be the ones that survived. So quite a different meaning. But the phrase took on a new meaning. And the thing that's very interesting is Darwin also had a much more subtle view of how evolution works than economists tend to think he had. So they associate it with the individual, and as I said, with the greed and selfishness and so on. But Darwin wrote another book called The Descent of Man, and in that book he argued the human species has succeeded because of characteristics like sharing and compassion. What he wrote was this: those communities which included the greatest number of the most sympathetic members would flourish best and rear the greatest number of offspring. So sympathetic in the 18th and 19th century was much closer in meaning to what we would call empathic. So he's saying those communities which have the most empathic and cooperative people would be the ones that would survive the best and would rear the greatest number of offspring. And he wrote this: although a high standard of morality gives only a slight or no advantage to each individual man and his children over men of the same tribe, an advancement in the standard of morality will certainly give an immense advantage to one tribe over another. A tribe that includes many members who, from possessing a high degree of spirit of patriotism, fidelity, obedience, courage, and sympathy, or empathy, and were always ready to help one another and to sacrifice themselves for the common good, they would be victorious over most other tribes, and this would be natural selection. So what he was arguing was that natural selection operates at the level of the individual and operates at the level of the group. And in order to operate at the level of the group, values and attitudes and morality connected with sharing and compassion must come to the fore. That's how the human species has survived and thrived. So he's describing, Darwin, two sides to human nature. The selfish individual who seeks to outdo others in their group, and the cooperative, empathic individual who combines with others for the success of the group. And the success of the human species depends upon empathy overcoming selfishness. And it's interesting, I read some more on this, how to look at how some evolutionary anthropologists say that this process actually happened in history. And there's a particular evolutionary anthropologist, a man called Christopher Byrne, and he has got a theory of how this change happened. And his theory is from looking back in time and also studying modern hunter-gatherers, those few societies that still exist of modern hunter-gatherers. And he says, probably about 250,000 years ago, hunter-gatherers realized, rather than having solo hunting, it was more effective when they cooperated together. So some people would drive the game towards others waiting, and when that happened, the number of kills that they made went up. So they realized that cooperating meant they had more to eat. But the interesting thing he says is it's not just a cooperative way of hunting that changed. It was also how they distributed the meat from the kill. And this was also changed because what happened was they were very, very watchful to make sure that people who didn't help with the hunt, so-called free riders, they just rode on the backs of others so that they would ridicule people like that. But not only that, they made sure that the strongest people in the hunt did not get a higher share of the kill. And the way they did this was that, for example, whoever actually killed the animal was not allowed to distribute the food. It was somebody else entirely who was chosen to distribute the food, so that the strongest people only got the same share as everybody else. So that it was a shift in terms of how they hunted and how they shared out the meat. And if anybody tried to be a free rider to take their share without helping, or if anybody tried to take more than their fair share because they were stronger, they ridiculed them. And ultimately they could expel them from the tribe, which meant that they were likely to die. So it was very strong measures of enforcement were brought in. And he says that what happens then is that these socially enforced rules created powerful pressures on individuals to become sort of self-controlled so that they would not be ridiculed by others and to avoid social penalties. And he says in this way, it began to shape our moral sense so that we internalize behavioral rules such that certain behaviors came to feel clearly right or wrong. And he argues that things like shame, a sense of shame and sense of guilt, emerged as evolutionary signals of this process. So what you see is a shift from what he describes as a previously fear-based social order to one that's based upon collaborative activities. and where the selection of partners for breeding shifts towards those who are most cooperative and away from those who are the strongest and the most selfish. Those who had a reputation for being poor cooperators were not selected as mates for breeding. And in this way, he argues, there's an interaction between the culture and natural evolutionary tendencies, genetic tendencies, so we bred ourselves for cooperation. And the empathic and altruistic tendencies in human society were strengthened, and they became part of our evolutionary inheritance. So we end up now with humans who have both a selfish tendency and an empathic and compassionate tendency. That's Christopher Boehm's argument. But just now to return to Charles Darwin, I mentioned how this phrase, survival of the fittest, caused problems, particularly with economists. And it caused problems also because it seemed to fit with the writings of this man called Adam Smith, who'd written about economics at the end of the 18th century. And it particularly seems to fit with something what Adam Smith called the invisible hand. If you read modern neoliberal economists, you would find this phrase, the invisible hand, and you think, what the heck's this? Sounds mystic almost, doesn't it? But for them it has a very particular meaning. And they base their meaning upon what Adam Smith wrote. And Adam Smith wrote in The Wealth of Nations, he wrote this: it is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love. In other words, he's saying, it's the self-interest of the butcher, the brewer, and the baker that leads to them producing food for us. They don't do it out of an altruistic concern for others. And he went on, he said, every individual labours to increase the annual revenue of society. They don't intend to promote the public interest. They intend only their own gain. But they are led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of their intention. So he's making an argument that if everybody pursues their own self-interest, through the working of the economic market, everybody benefits. So allowing people to pursue their own self-interest, their own selfish aims, promotes the well-being of society as a whole. So that this is his basic argument. And now, when you listen to modern economists, you'd think that's all there is to Adam Smith. They've taken this one idea, and this is what they promote from Adam Smith's ideas. But he was a moral philosopher. He wasn't an economist. He was the first to write about economics. He was a moral philosopher. And he wrote a book, another book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is actually a wonderful book and basically is a very good argument that pursuing money does not bring happiness. Pursuing money does not bring happiness. At the start of this other book, he wrote this: however selfish a man may be, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others, and they render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing them being happy. So he's saying that people clearly have a concern for the happiness of others. And he goes on, our fellow feeling for the misery of others is founded on our capacity for changing places in our imagination with the sufferer. And there's this whole passage where he's describing almost like a practice that you imagine yourself in the place of the other person who is suffering. Now, those of you who have read the Bodhicharya Avatara, Shantideva, the 8th century Buddhist teacher, exchange of self and other, a practice. And Adam Smith knew nothing about Buddhism, but he's writing in this book about something very similar idea. So there was another side to Adam Smith. So he understood, actually, like Charles Darwin, that people's behaviour is not just dictated by self-interest, but derives from a variety of motives. So there are two sides to human nature: the selfish, self-interested side, and the kind, compassionate side. But maybe the difference, there was a difference between Charles Darwin and Adam Smith, because Darwin was clear: empathy must win out over selfishness for the human species to progress. In Adam Smith's case, you've got these two books, and the tension between them is unresolved. It's very difficult to reconcile the two sides. It's almost as if he's writing about a personal space where empathy and compassion matter, and an impersonal space where selfishness thrives. And I'll come back to that unresolved tension later. So how does the Buddha relate to this? Well, we know the Buddha identified greed, hatred and delusion as the root causes of the human predicament. Because of greed, hatred and delusion, we are unable to find true fulfillment in our lives. That's one of the basic messages of the Buddha. We are born with the potential for greed, hatred and delusion. But of course, the Buddha said, we are also born with the potential for generosity, loving kindness and wisdom. And which potential dominates depends upon what we turn our minds towards and what we cultivate in our lives. So the Buddha, like the other thinkers of the Axial Age, emphasized putting ethics at the center of the spiritual life in the pursuit of fulfillment and a new kind of humanity. Empathy and compassion have to be developed, and greed and egotism are to be shaken off. And like the other wise people of the Axial Age, the Buddha was clear that compassion and altruism are not to be confined to your own immediate group or your own people, but instead have to be extended beyond. The Buddha prescribed the practice of kindness towards all human beings and all living creatures found in nature. Many of you will be familiar with the Karaniya Metta Sutta, in which the Buddha enjoins his followers to cultivate the following intention: whatsoever living beings exist, without exception, whether weak or strong, whether tall and large, middle-sized or short, whether very subtle or very gross, whether visible or invisible, dwelling far away or not far away, whether born already or not yet born, may all beings be happy in themselves. So the Buddha is enjoining us to practice kindness towards all living creatures, including those not yet born, which I think has a great deal of significance in terms of the kind of economic and environmental issues that we face. So we're being asked to be kind towards future generations of humans and other species on the planet. And in addition to that, the Buddha always emphasized generosity. So when you read the early teachings of the Buddha in the Pali Canon, you find that whenever he meets a new group of people or he meets a new individual and he's giving them teachings from the beginning, he nearly always starts with talking about generosity. So the practice of giving of Dana is the foundation and the seed of spiritual development. We read that time and time again. Talk on giving was the first topic often to be discussed by the Buddha when he was teaching. So if we're going to fulfill our progressive evolutionary potential, the Buddha is advocating the cultivation of an ethical path of care and compassion. And he said this is a path that is to be followed at the level of the individual and at all other levels of society and of the world. And I'm emphasizing that because it's often thought that the Buddha's teachings were directed only at monks and nuns. But when you read the Pali Canon, you realize that a significant minority of his teachings were concerned with the wider society, were concerned with the world of family and local community, the world of work and business, the world of kings and queens and government policy makers. He engaged with social, political and economic issues beyond the needs of the monks and nuns who had left home. And his concern was to help in the development of a stable society governed by ethical principles that would reduce suffering and create the conditions to assist people generally to develop their potential and to find fulfillment, and to provide an environment, a wider society, in which the attainment of enlightenment, the conditions for the attainment of enlightenment, were the best possible. But when we look at modern economics, we find that the pursuit of selfishness is promoted as being the way to well-being for society. It's almost like a mantra. You know, economists have a mantra. Selfishness is the way to economic well-being. It's like an ethic that supersedes all other ethical considerations. There's a Nobel Prize winning economist called Joseph Stiglitz, and he's a critic of the dominant form of economics in the world today. And he said this about this idea that selfishness is the way forward. He says, to the morally uninspired, it's an appealing idea. Selfishness is the ultimate form of selflessness. By being selfish, you are helping everybody, so you're being selfless. And this allows you to justify almost anything that you can do, unethical or otherwise, to promote your own pay and so on, promote the interests of your own company, because behind it is the belief that that is the way to the economic well-being for all. And if you doubt that, I'm going to tell you about a man called Lawrence Summers. He's a senior economist in the United States. He's not a Republican. He's not a man of the right wing. He's been economic advisor to both President Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. He was also, for a while, the president of Harvard University. And when he was there, he gave a talk on what economics can contribute to thinking about moral questions. And I'm going to read out now something that he said in that talk. One of the things that bothers many people of faith about market mechanisms is the idea that there is something wrong with a system where we are able to buy bread only because of the greed or the profit motive of the people who make the bread. Here, I would be very cautious. And he goes on. Listen carefully. We all only have so much altruism in us, or so much generosity in us. Economists like me think of altruism as a valuable and rare good that needs to be conserved. Far better to conserve altruism by designing an economic system in which people's wants will be satisfied by individuals being selfish and saving altruism for our families and our friends and the many social problems in this world that the markets cannot solve. So just think about that. He's saying that altruism is like a rare commodity or good that can be used up. Generosity is a faculty, an attitude that can be used up, and we have to conserve. Sorry? So he's basically saying that altruism, generosity, and even love are like resources with a limited supply. They're like a fossil fuel that is diminished with every time you use it. So every time you are generous, you are reducing the amount of generosity that you have within you. Every time you are altruistic or care for somebody, you are reducing the amount of care that is potentially there within you.
He believes that.
Oh, yes. And most mainstream economists will firmly believe this. That's the basis for their economic system. Now, you don't need to be a Buddhist to see through this. There's a man called Michael Sandel who's written a lovely book called What Money Can't Buy. And in that book he says this: altruism, generosity, solidarity and civic spirit are not like commodities that are depleted with use. They are more like muscles that develop and grow stronger with exercise. One of the defects of a market-driven society is that it lets these virtues languish. It lets them drift away. To renew our public life, we must exercise those qualities more strenuously. We know this, don't we? Why do we practice the metta bhavana? We strengthen our ability to be kind and compassionate and caring for others. And it's quite extraordinary to have this idea that if you're generous in one place, you have less generosity for others in other places. But this is what they believe. And this is the crux of the matter, I think. From a Buddhist perspective, the key to judging a social or economic system is the ethical values that underlie that system. And to subordinate any society to an economic system that extols or praises or raises greed and selfishness is profoundly wrong. Economic organisation must be subordinated to the needs of human society and to the values of empathy and compassion. So how to do that? Well, in large part, it's a battle for hearts and minds. It's a battle for values. There's a really interesting economist from the Czech Republic called Tomáš Sedláček. He was actually an advisor to Václav Havel when he was the president of the old Czechoslovakia. And he says this: our time lacks moderation. We have to try to achieve more self-control. The English poet John Milton put it brilliantly: he who reigns within himself and rules passions, desires and fears is more than a king. He's saying we have to rein in this rampant greed. He who reigns within himself and rules passions, desires and fears is more than a king. And when you read that by John Milton, it's just like the Buddha. 2,500 years earlier in the Dhammapada, though one should conquer in battle thousands upon thousands of men, he who conquers himself is truly the greatest in battle. So those who conquer their tendency towards selfishness and greed are the greatest in battle. So this is what we're engaged in. It's a battle over the values of the society in which we live, how we live. So the problem of economics and capitalism at heart is a spiritual problem. You may hear all sorts of, and even I can make all sorts of suggestions for different ways that you can run an economy. But at heart, the crux of the matter is a spiritual problem about our values, ethical values. And that's why the Buddha gave teachings on family, on community, on work and business, and engaged with kings and queens and policymakers. So how are we doing for time? Are we okay for me to carry on for a little while longer? Yeah. So I want to introduce another perspective, which I think helps to give a view on these issues. And it's the Buddha's teaching of pratityasamutpada, the Buddha's teaching of conditionality or conditioned arising. So in a way, this is, if you like, I think it's like the core teaching of the Buddha. And in its most succinct expression, the one that I really like, it goes like this. This being that becomes, with the arising of this, that arises. This not being that does not become, with the ceasing of this, that ceases. It sounds deceptively simple. But what it's telling is that everything, including ourselves, exists in dependence upon conditions. Nothing exists completely separately. Nothing is fixed and permanent. What we think of as things are in reality processes which exist in dependence upon other processes and which themselves create the conditions for even more processes to exist. And if the conditions are right, then something completely new can emerge. So when you think about the process of evolution, the process of evolution is an example of conditioned arising at work. If the conditions change, if the environment changes, then the path of evolution changes. Christopher Boehm's description of how, with a new way of hunting, altruism and cooperation came to be a natural part of the human evolutionary inheritance is another example of conditionality at work. An economic development and the emergence of capitalism is another example of conditionality or conditioned arising at work. So when you look at the arising of capitalism, you'll find that there's huge arguments. What were the conditions that led to the arising of capitalism? So some people will talk about the Protestant work ethic and the influence of the Protestant Reformation on the arising of capitalism. Some people will talk about new forms of governance like democracy, basic embryonic forms of democracy. Some will talk about the new emergence of new kinds of financial systems. And some will emphasize the wealth that was created by forcibly removing native peoples off their land in the Americas and in Africa. While Native Americans were dispossessed of their land, 12 million Africans were shipped from one side of the Atlantic to the other. And closer to home, for me, in England, there was what's called the enclosure movement, where land was common, everybody could use it. And basically, it was taken over by private landlords. In Scotland, you had what's called the Highland clearances, where people were cleared off the land to make way for sheep. So in different parts of the world, you can see how people were forcibly removed to create the conditions for the growth of wealth. If you ever visit Liverpool in England, you go to the seafront, the docks area, all the way around those areas, you see these magnificent buildings. Really impressive, magnificent buildings from the 19th century. Created from the proceeds of the slave trade. That's what you're seeing. It's actually the wealth that came in through the slave trade. But whatever your views are about the particular importance of the different conditions that led to the arising of capitalism, somehow or other, a variety of conditions came together and a new, undeniably dynamic form of economic organisation arose. And it's clear that however much people can talk about an unrestrained form of capitalism, one of the conditions that played a major part in the arising of capitalism and still continues to play a major part in our economic organisation is the rules and regulations devised by governments. Governments play a critical part in the formation of our economic systems. So rules and regulations that can operate at a local level or a national level or an international level are critical conditions for the emergence of economic organisation of different kinds. So that when we are faced with modern debates about economic regulations, we need to think about what are the values that lie behind these particular forms of regulation. What is going on at a deeper level here? Is this the promotion of greed and selfishness, or is it something else? We need to ask, are the rules and regulations which are debated nationally and internationally, are they for the benefit of human society or to the detriment of human society? Do they promote greed and selfishness, or do they promote their opposites? And I'm raising this because travelling around the UK and Western Europe and the Nordic area, travelling around in Australia and New Zealand, and a couple of weeks ago I was in Canada, in Toronto, giving a talk to a group of development economists. One of the issues that's really being talked about is a set of agreements that in the Pacific area is known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and in the Atlantic area is known as the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. These are international agreements, economic agreements. Might sound very boring, but they're not. Because actually, it's quite possible that the future of humanity depends upon whether these agreements are put into full effect or not. The Trans-Pacific Partnership was recently signed by representatives of all the governments. It's not yet implemented because it's got to be debated now in each of the different countries. But to consider it, I want to actually focus the importance of this. I want to focus on corporations and particularly on multinational corporations. And I'm going to step back to do that by going back to the Buddha. Because the Buddha teaches us that our view of the self as fixed and unchanging and separate, that view is false. In cultivating our inherited tendencies for generosity and kindness, we can go beyond our equally inherited tendencies for selfishness. We can change ourselves for the better. We can change and evolve into individuals who realize that they, like all phenomena, are empty of a fixed self-nature, and who are interconnected with all things. Now, I'm talking about that because when you look at a corporation or a multinational corporation, the way that they are legally conceived is that they are conceived as something like a virtual individual. They are treated as individuals. So they can make decisions like individuals do. And in some countries, in the law, they are actually seen as individuals. So you can argue that with the creation of the corporation and the multinational corporation, we are legally and financially creating a purely selfish, profit-oriented individual that exists solely for the benefit of its shareholders. A corporation must make profits for the benefit of its shareholders. If it tries to do something else, it might actually be stepping out of what it legally and constitutionally is allowed to do. So I have a friend called David Loy, who's a socially engaged Buddhist in the United States. And he sums this up. He says, a corporation cannot love. a corporation cannot love. It's not allowed to. It cannot develop from a purely selfish, profit-oriented nature of organisation to something else. So we have deliberately allowed the designing of an individual that cannot evolve from selfishness to kindness. Unlike other individuals, multinational corporations have an enormous amount of power, which they wield through putting money into different political parties and individuals at election times and so on around the world and so on. And what we are doing now with these new agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, you may not be aware of this, but there's an establishment of what are called arbitration panels. So multinational corporations can sue governments for very large sums of money if governments introduce new environmental or other measures designed to benefit the people of that country, which might in the process reduce the profits of those companies. So you must know that there is, what's it called? The Swedish, partially owned by the state, energy company that is suing the German government now for huge sums of money because the German government has cancelled its nuclear power program. And they're claiming very large sums from the German government. You have cases where tobacco companies have sued the governments of Australia and Uruguay for putting graphic images of what cigarette smoking does to you on cigarette packets. Very successful, because it's reduced the sales of cigarettes in Uruguay and Australia, and therefore reduced the profits. So they've been suing the governments for compensation. You had the environmental agreement recently in Paris. Well, these new trade agreements will outweigh whatever agreements were made there if a company decides that it's going to damage, environmental measures will damage its profits. That takes priority. So I'm giving this an example of how we need to be aware and look beyond the purely economic to the values that lie behind them. And I want to finish by dealing with an issue that comes up sometimes where people say, well, we're Buddhists and we shouldn't really get involved in arguments about economics and politics and so on. And to remind you of the man who had a tremendous impact upon Bhante Sangharakshita and who had a tremendous impact upon what Bhante Sangharakshita was trying to create with the creation of the Tri Ratna Buddhist community, and that is Dr. Ambedkar in India. Because when you look at Dr. Ambedkar, you know, he was an Indian political activist. He was the leader of the Dalits, the so-called ex-untouchables. He basically wrote most of the drafts, at least, for the Indian constitution. And when he considered how he could help to forward the economic, political and social aims of the Dalits, he considered political alternatives and different religious alternatives, and he alighted upon Buddhism as being the best way forward for his people. And you look at his life, it's a life of political and social activism. Many different activities, supporting trade unions at different times, supporting all sorts of activities. Unrelenting struggle and basically self-sacrifice in favour of the needs of his people. And he came up with this formulation of the ideal society. And his ideal society was to be based around liberty, equality and fraternity. Phrases which were borrowed from the French Revolution, but which he gave a different set of meanings. And to finish, I just want to remind you of what those meanings are. So liberty means that people are free to live the kind of life that they consider best, as long as they do not harm or infringe the liberty of others. Equality means that everybody has broadly the same opportunities to make the most of their life. It doesn't mean that we're all equal in some flat sense. It means that we all have, as far as possible, the equal opportunity to make the most of our life, whatever that leads to. And fraternity means an attitude of respect and even reverence, he said, of each citizen for each other. And he equated this attitude of fraternity with democracy itself. And democracy, he said, is not merely a means of choosing a government. It is a state of mind, a fraternal attitude that is ultimately one of loving kindness, which expresses itself in moral and ethical action. So I think I'll leave you with Dr. Ambedkar. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that, Vanika. Very informative, well-researched. I was very interested in the Buddhist perspective, and particularly with the TPPA, which was signed in New Zealand, sobering that sovereignty will be displaced by corporate management. So some very interesting information and very informative, and thank you for that. And we look forward to having you again at the earliest opportunity.
Good.
And share in your knowledge and research. And I'm very interested to see what you come up with this time. Vanika, in the spring, is going off to Adistana for 3 months to research and write. So watch that space and see what he comes up with. So thanks very much again, Vanika, and once again. So we'll leave it there.
Okay. That went on a bit long, did it?
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, okay. Sorry.
And we've got five minutes before.
Ten
minutes. Has anyone got any questions?
Yep. So what shall I do?
Yeah.
Shall I do?
Well, I'm not going to tell you what to do. But, okay. Yeah. I mean, the first time I gave a talk or anything around these themes, and I thought, great, really good. And then somebody says, what shall I do? And I'm thinking, oh my God, I haven't got a clue. Don't record that. Oh, it's still recording. No, I think it's an interesting question. I think each of us is different. And so I'm not saying that we should all rush off and man the barricades. I think that each of us has to look for, is there an issue that we feel some kind of heart connection with that might help to change things for the better? And if there is and it keeps calling to us, then maybe we should respond to it. It may come about completely unexpectedly. And it's going to be different for each of us. And not all of us would be able to do that kind of thing anyway, because for some of us, maybe our major effort is actually in working for the Sangha and helping build a Sangha base from which some of us at least can go out into the world. Because one of my concerns is that when I'm asked this sort of question is, it's I don't want people to go rushing off and to leave the Sangha behind. Because there's a great danger if you spend a lot of time out in outside activities and you don't stay in your base in the Sangha, then you can easily lose your values and get sucked into activities in a way that are detrimental to your spiritual practice. So the key to it is you have your individual practice. That's the basic building block. Then you do your individual practice and you combine with others in the Sangha, and you talk about what's going on in your life and whatever other activities you're engaged with. You must stay solidly within the Sangha. And then, if there is space, you get involved in something. It could be, you know, whatever it is that actually calls to you. So Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about how you can sit with this and meditate with it over several weeks. You may have some ideas of issues that call to you. And you wait and see which one keeps calling to you. And maybe that's the one that you get involved in. My concern is to encourage people within the Sangha not just to be focused on their individual practice, but to be aware that there is much going on in the wider society that can affect all of us, and that we have something really important to contribute through what we know and practice as Buddhists, values and practices that we can help to take out to others. So that we are focused inward with our own practice, we're focused within our wider Sangha here, and we're focused out there in some way or other. We need to be careful in getting the balance right with that so you don't burn out. So whatever, you know, you personally will know what kinds of things call to you. So I'm not going to say what you should respond to.
It occurs to me that maybe Buddhist Action Month is a good time of year to just not necessarily to do something, but to start thinking about it in June.
Yeah.
Because there will be people all over Sri Ratna who will be looking at the same kinds of questions rooted in their practice.
And the environment is a very important issue, but it's not the only issue. That's the other thing that I would say. There are many issues on which people can engage. The environment is often the most prominent one, but it's not the only one. And one could make an argument that the environment is an issue because of the crux of it is the economic system that we have and the values of that, and the environmental problems will not be solved until we succeed in bringing about a transformation in the dominant values in society.
I mean, the values about the environment, I mean, you can include the economic, you can include the social change, and you can include the ecological.
Yes, yeah.
All these in...
meshed together.
Comes together.
The other thing I would add is that... there are some people, very well-meaning people, who argue that we need to change the economic structure, which is great, and I think they're right. But they believe that if you change the economic structure, that somehow or other values will change after that. I don't think it works that way. We have to challenge the values. Because you know, it is really about a spiritual transformation. Just changing the material structure of society isn't going to change those values. Nothing happens automatically. We really have to take our values out into the world.
Did you take that?
Yes.
We just scrubbed the other bit earlier.
I just want to mention, I have a book at home. We have a book at home that is called The Change, what is called The Change, the book is called, the title, the Songs from the Earth, but the undertitle is Change Starts from Within.
Very good.
It expresses what you said, I think.
Okay. Maybe that's a good point to stop. Should we finish there? Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you.